kneeling in the center of the chamber, deep in meditation. Bane had been in this room before, but he couldn't help but marvel at the extravagance. The walls were adorned with expensive tapestries and hangings. Golden braziers and censers burning heavy incense were scattered haphazardly about to provide a dim glow in the hazy air. In one corner was a large, luxuriant bed. In another was an intricately carved table of obsidian, a small chest atop it. The lid of the chest was open, revealing the jewelry inside. Necklaces and chains of precious metals, rings of gold and platinum encrusted with ostentatious gemstones. Cordis took great pains to surround himself with material goods and the trappings of wealth, and he took greater pains to make sure others noticed his opulence. On some level, Bane suspected the Sith Lord derived pleasure and power from the covetous desire and greed his possessions inspired in others. The trinkets held little interest for Bane, however. He was more impressed with the manuscripts and tomes that lined the bookshelves along the wall, each a magnificent volume clad in leather embossed with gold leaf. Many of the volumes were thousands of years old, and he knew they contained the secrets of the ancient Sith. At last, Lord Cordis rose to his feet, standing tall and straight, so he could look down on his student with his gray, sunken eyes.
"Kasim told me what happened yesterday morning," he said. "He tells me you are responsible for Fohark's death."
The tone of his voice gave Bane no clues as to his emotional state.
"I am not responsible for his death,"
Bane answered calmly. He was angry, but he wasn't stupid. He chose his next words very carefully. He wanted to convince Lord Cordis not to enrage him.
"Fohark was the one who let his guard down. He left himself vulnerable in the ring. It would have shown weakness not to take advantage of it."
His statement wasn't entirely factual, but it was close enough to the truth. One of the first lessons Kasim taught students was how to build a protective shield around themselves in combat to prevent an enemy from using the force against them. A force-talented opponent could yank away your lightsaber, knock you off balance, or even extinguish your lightsaber's blade without the touch of a hand or weapon. A force shield was the most basic and most necessary protection there was. It had become instinctive for all the apprentices, almost second nature. As soon as the blade was drawn, the protective veil went up, guarding against the force powers of the enemy and obscuring your own intentions required as much concentration and energy as augmenting your physical prowess or anticipating the moves of your foe. It was that unseen part of combat, the invisible battle of wills, not the obvious interaction of bodies and blades, that more often than not decided the fate of a duel.
"Kasim says Fohark did not lower his guard,"
Cordis countered.
"He says you simply ripped through it. His defenses could not stand before your power."
"Master, are you saying I should hold back if my opponent is weak?"
It was a loaded question, of course, one Cordis didn't even bother to answer.
"It is one thing to defeat an opponent in the ring, but even once he was down, you continued to attack him. He was beaten long before you killed him. What you did was no different from striking with the blade against a fallen and unconscious foe. Something that is not permitted in the training ring."
The words struck too close to home, dredging up the guilt Bane had tried to bury even as he had made his way to this meeting. Cordis was silent, waiting for Bane's reaction. Bane had to make some type of reply, but the only answer he could come up with was a question he'd wrestled with in the twilight hours before dawn.
"Kasim knew what was happening. He could see what I was doing. Why didn't he stop me?"
"Why not indeed?"
Cordis replied smoothly.
"Lord Kasim wanted to see what would happen. He wanted to see how you would act in that situation. He wanted to see if you would be merciful, or if you would be strong."
And suddenly Bane realized he hadn't been called into the Master's room to be punished.
I don't understand. I thought it was forbidden to murder another apprentice.
Cordis nodded.
We cannot have the students attacking each other in the halls. We want your hatred to be directed against the Jedi, not one another.
The words echoed the argument Bane had been having with himself only minutes earlier.
But what came next was something he hadn't anticipated.
Despite this, Forhark's death may turn out to be a minor loss, if it helps you to achieve your full potential. Exceptions can be made for those who are strong in the dark side.
Loxirak,
Bane asked, the words out of his mouth before he even realized what he was saying. Fortunately, the question seemed to amuse Lord Cordis, rather than offend him.
Sirak understands the power of the dark side,
he said with a smile.
Passion fuels the dark side.
Peace is a lie, there is only passion,
Bane muttered out of habit.
Through passion I gain strength.
Exactly.
Cordis seemed pleased, though with himself or his student it was hard to tell.
Through strength I gain power, through power I gain victory.
Through victory my chains are broken,
Bane dutifully recited.
Understand this, truly understand it, and your potential is limitless.
Cordis gave a dismissive wave of his hand, then settled back onto his meditation mat as Bane turned to go. At the door of the room, though, the young man paused and turned back.
What is the Sithari?
He blurted out. Cordis tilted his head to the side.
Where did you hear that word?
His voice was grave.
I've heard some of the other students use it, about Sirak. They say he could be the Sithari.
Some of the old texts speak of the Sithari,
Cordis answered slowly, gesturing with a ring-laden claw at the books scattered about the room.
They say the Sith will one day be led by a perfect being, one who embodies the dark side and all we stand for. Sirak is this perfect being?
Cordis shrugged.
Sirak is the strongest student at the academy. For now. Perhaps in time he will surpass Cassim and me and all the other Sith Lords. Perhaps not.
He paused.
Many of the Masters do not believe in the legend of the Sithari,
he continued after a moment.
Lord Khan discounts it for one. It goes against the philosophy underlying the Brotherhood of Darkness.
What about you, Master? Do you believe in the legend?
Bane waited, while Cordis considered his reply. It felt like forever.
These are dangerous questions to ask,
the Dark Lord finally said.
But if the Sithari is more than a legend, he will not simply be born as the exemplar of all our teachings. He, or she, must be forged in the crucibles of trial and battle to attain such perfection. Some might argue such training is the purpose of this academy, but I would counter by insisting that we train our apprentices to join the ranks of the Sith Lords, so they may stand alongside Khan and the rest of the Brotherhood.
Realizing that was as good an answer as he was going to get, Bane nodded and left. He had been absolved of his crime, given a pardon because of his power and potential. He should have been exultant, triumphant, but for some reason, all he could think about as he headed up to the roof to join the other students was the sticky gurgles of Fulharg's dying breaths. That night, in the privacy of his room, Bane struggled to make sense of what had happened. He sought the deeper wisdom behind the Master's words. Cordis had said that his emotions, his anger, had let him summon up the strength to defeat Fulharg. He said passion fueled the dark side. Bane had felt this enough times to know it was true. But he couldn't shake the feeling that there was more to it than that. He didn't consider himself a cruel person. He didn't believe he was ruthless or sadistic. Yet how else to explain what he had done to the helpless McCurth? It had been murder, or execution, and Bane was having trouble accepting it. He had a lot of blood on his hands. He'd killed hundreds, maybe even thousands of Republic soldiers, but that had been war. And the ensign he'd killed on Apatros had been a case of self-defense. Those were all cases of kill or be killed. And he had no regrets about what he'd done, unlike yesterday. No matter how he tried, he couldn't find a way to justify what had happened in the ring. Foharg had taunted him, feeding his rage and lethal fury. Yet he couldn't even use the excuse that he'd been swept up in the heat of the moment. Not if he was being honest with himself. He'd felt his emotions raging through him as he'd drawn on the dark side. But the act itself had been cold and deliberate, calculating even. Lying in his bed, Bane couldn't help but wonder if the relationship between passion and the dark side was more complex than Cordis had made it seem. He closed his eyes, thinking back on what had happened. He took slow, deep breaths, trying to stay calm and detached so he could analyze what had gone wrong. He had been humiliated and embarrassed, and he'd responded with anger. His anger had let him summon the dark side to lash out at his enemy. He could remember a feeling of elation, of triumph, when Foharg went sprawling through the air. But there was something else, too. Even in victory, his hatred had kept growing, rising up like the flames of a fire that could be quenched only with blood. Passion fueled the dark side. But what if the dark side also fueled passion? Emotion brought power, but that power increased the intensity of those emotions, which in turn led to an increase in the power. In the right circumstances, it would create a cycle that would end only when a person reached the limits of his or her ability to command the force, or when the target of his or her anger and hatred was destroyed. Despite the heat in his room, a cold shiver ran down Bane's spine. How was it possible to contain or control a power that fed on itself? The more he, as an apprentice, learned to draw on the force, the more his emotions would control him. The stronger a person became, the less rational he would be. It was inevitable. No, Bane thought, he was missing something. He had to be. If this were true, the masters would be teaching the students techniques to avoid this situation. They would be learning to distance themselves from their own emotions, even as they used them to draw upon the dark side. But there was nothing of this in their training. So Bane's analysis had to be wrong. It had to be. Somewhat reassured, Bane let his thoughts drift into the comfort of sleep.
"You make me sick,"
his father spat.
"Look how much you eat. You're worse than a criffing zucker pig."
Dez tried to ignore him. He hunkered down in his seat at the dinner table and concentrated on the food on his plate, shoveling slow forkfuls into his mouth.
"Did you hear me, boy?"
his father snapped.
"You think that food in front of you is free? I gotta pay for that food, you know. I worked every day this week, and I still owe more now than I did at the beginning of the blasted month."
Hurst was drunk as usual. His eyes were glassy, and he still reeked of the mines. He hadn't even bothered to shower before hitting the bottle he kept tucked away beneath the covers of his cot.
"You want me to start working double shifts to support you, boy?"
he shouted. Without looking up from his plate, Dez muttered,
"I work just as many shifts as you do."
"What?"
Hurst said, his voice dropping down to a menacing whisper.
"What did you just say?"
Instead of biting his lip, Dez looked up from his plate and right into his father's red, bleary eyes.
"I said, I work as many shifts as you do. And I'm only 18.
Hurst pushed his chair away from the table and rose.
18, and still too dumb to know when to keep your mouth shut."
He shook his head from side to side in exaggerated disappointment.
"Bloody bane of my existence is what you are."
Throwing his fork down on his plate, Dez pushed his own chair back from the table and stood up to his full height. He was taller than his father now, and his frame was beginning to fill out with muscles earned in the tunnels.
"Are you going to beat me now?"
he snarled at his father.
"Going to teach me a lesson?"
Hurst's jaw dropped open.
"What the bricks is wrong with you, boy? I'm sick of this,"
Dez snapped.
"You blame all your problems on me, But you're the one who's drinking away all our credits. Maybe if you sobered up, we could get off this stinking world. You smart-mouthed mud-crotch whelp!
Hurst roared, flipping the table so it crashed against the wall. He leapt across the now empty space between them and grabbed Dez by his wrists in a grip as unbreakable as a pair of Durasteel binders. The young man tried to wrench free, but his father outweighed him by 20-some kilos, almost half of which was muscle. Knowing it was hopeless, Dez stopped struggling after a few seconds, but he wasn't going to cower and cry. Not this time.
If you're going to beat me tonight, he said, remember that it might be the last time, old man. You better make it a good one.
Hurst did. He lit into his son with the savage fury of a bitter, hopeless man. He broke his nose. He blackened both his eyes. He knocked out two of his teeth, split his lip, and cracked his ribs. But throughout it all, Dez never said a word. And he didn't shed a single tear. That night, as Dez lay in his bed too bruised and swollen to sleep, a single thought kept running through his mind, drowning out the loud, drunken snores of Hurst passed out in the corner. I hope you die. I hope you die. I hope you die. He'd never hated his father as much as he did at that moment. He envisioned a giant hand squeezing his father's cruel heart. I hope you die. I hope you die. I hope you die. The words rolled over and over, an endless mantra, as if he could make them come true through sheer force of will. I hope you die. I hope you die. I hope you die. The tears he'd held back during the brutal thrashing finally came, hot drops streaming down his purple, swollen face. I hope you die. I hope you die. I hope you... Bane woke with a start, his heart pounding, and his body bathed in terror sweat as he thrashed against the covers tangled around his legs. For a brief second, he thought he was back in Apatros in the cramped room filled with Hurst and the overwhelming stench of booze. Then he realized where he was, and the nightmare began to fade. A horrible realization swept in to take its place. Hurst had died that night. The authorities had ruled it a natural death. A heart attack, brought on by a combination of too much alcohol, a life working in the mines, and the overexertion of nearly beating his own son to death with his bare hands. They never suspected the real cause. Neither had Bane. Not until now. Trembling slightly, he rolled over, exhausted, but knowing sleep wouldn't come again this night. Tholharg wasn't the first person he had murdered with the Force. He probably wouldn't be the last. Bane was smart enough to understand that. He shook his head to clear away the memory of Hurst's death. The man had deserved neither pity nor mercy. The weak would always be crushed by the strong. If Bane wanted to survive, he had to become one of the strong. That was why he was here at the Academy. That was his mission. That was the way of the dark side. But the realization did nothing to quell the queasy feeling in his stomach. And when he closed his eyes, he could still see Father's face. Chapter 12.
No!
Kasim barked, disdainfully slapping Bane's training saber aside with his own weapon.
Wrong!
You're too slow on the first transition. You're leaving your left side wide open for a quick counter.
The Blade Master was teaching him a new sequence. He'd been teaching it to him for more than a week. But for some reason, Bane couldn't seem to grasp the intricacies of the movements. His blade felt clumsy and awkward in his hand. He stepped back and resumed the ready position. Kasim studied him briefly, then dropped into a defensive stance in front of him. Bane took a deep breath to focus his mind before letting his body trigger the sequence once again. His muscles moved instinctively, exploding into action. There was a hiss as the downstroke of his blade carved through the air in the first move, a blur of motion, but far too slow. Kasim responded by slipping to the side and bringing his own double-bladed weapon around in a long, swift arc that struck Bane hard in the ribs. The breath whooshed out of him, and he felt the searing pain of the Pelko barbs, followed by the all-too-familiar numbness spreading up through the left side of his torso. He staggered back helpless as Kasim watched silently. Bane struggled to stay upright and failed, collapsing awkwardly to the floor. The Blade Master shook his head in disappointment. Bane dragged himself to his feet, trying not to let his frustration show. It had been nearly 3 weeks since he'd beaten Fulharg in the ring, and since that time, he'd been training with Kasim in individual sessions to improve his lightsaber combat. But for some reason, he wasn't making any progress.
"Sorry, Master. I will go practice the drills again,"
he said through gritted teeth. "Drills," the Twi'lek repeated, his voice cruel and mocking. "What good will that do?"
I must learn the sequence better to become faster."
Kasim spat on the ground.
"If you truly believe that, then you're a fool."
Bane didn't know how to respond, so he kept silent. The Blade Master stepped forward and gave him a sharp cuff on his ear. It was meant not to hurt, but to humiliate.
"Fulharg was better trained than you," he snapped. "He knew more sequences. He knew more forms. But they couldn't save him. The sequences are just tools. They help you free your mind so you can draw upon the Force. That is where you will find the key to victory. Not in the muscles of your arms or the quickness of your blade. You must call upon the dark side to destroy your enemies."
Clenching his jaw from the burning pain, now spreading through the entire left side of his body, Bane could only nod.
"You're holding back,"
the Master went on.
"You aren't using the Force. Without it, your moves are slow and predictable."
I'll try harder, Master."
"Try!"
Kasim turned away in disgust.
"You've lost your will to fight. This lesson is over."
Realizing he'd been dismissed, Bane slowly made his way to the stairs leading down from the temple roof. As he reached them, Kasim called out one last piece of advice.
"Return when you are ready to embrace the dark side, instead of pulling away from it."
Bane didn't turn to look back. The pain and numbness of his left side made that impossible. But as he hobbled down the stairs, Lord Kasim's words echoed in his ears with the ring of truth. This wasn't the first training session he had failed in, and his failures weren't limited to Kasim and the lightsaber. Bane had gained in both reputation and prestige when he defeated Fulharg. Several of the masters had shown a sudden willingness to give him individual one-on-one training. Yet despite the extra attention, Bane's skills hadn't progressed at all. If anything, he'd actually taken several steps back. He made his way through the halls to his room, then lay down gingerly on his bed. There wasn't anything he could do while he was temporarily crippled by the Pelko venom except rest and meditate. It was obvious something was wrong, but he couldn't say exactly what. He no longer felt sharp. He no longer felt alive. When he had first become conscious of the Force flowing through him, his senses had become hyper-aware. The world had seemed more vibrant and more real. Now, everything was muted and distant. He walked through the halls of the academy as if he was in some kind of trance. He wasn't sleeping well. He kept having nightmares. Sometimes he dreamed of his father on the night he died. Other times he dreamed of his fight with Fulharg. Sometimes the dreams blended together, merging into one terrible vision. The McCurth beating him in the apartment on Apatros, his father lying dead in the dueling ring atop the temple on Korriban. And each time, Bane would wake choking back a scream, shivering, even though his body was bathed in sweat. But it was more than just lack of sleep that left him in a dazed stupor. The passion that had driven him was gone. The raging fire inside him had vanished, replaced by a cold emptiness. And without his passion, he was unable to summon the power of the dark side. It was becoming harder and harder to command the Force. The changes were subtle, barely noticeable at first. But over time, small changes built up. Now moving even small objects left him exhausted. He was slow and clumsy with the training saber. He could no longer anticipate what his opponents would do. He could only react after the fact. He couldn't deny it any longer. He was regressing. Apprentices he had surpassed long ago had caught up to him again. He could tell he was falling behind just by watching the other students during their studies, which meant they could probably tell too. He thought back on what the Twi'lek master had told him. You've lost your will to fight. Cassim was right. Bane had felt it slipping away since his first dream of his father. Unfortunately, he had no idea how to reclaim the anger and competitive fire that had fueled his meteoric rise through the hierarchy of Sith apprentices. Return when you are ready to embrace the dark side, instead of pulling away from it. Something was holding him back. Some part of him recoiled from what he had become. He would meditate for hours each day, concentrating his mind in search of the swirling, pulsing fury of the dark side locked away within him. Yet, he searched in vain. A cold veil had fallen across the core of his being, and try as he might, he couldn't tear it aside to seize the power that lay beneath. And he was running out of time. So far, nobody had dared to challenge him in the dueling ring, not since Fohark's death. The McCurth's gruesome end still inspired enough fear in the other students for them to steer clear of him. But Bane knew they wouldn't keep their distance much longer. His confidence and abilities were waning, and his failures were becoming more public. Soon it would be as obvious to the other students as it was to him. In those first days after Fohag's death, his only true rival had been Sirak. Now every apprentice on Korriban was a potential threat. The hopelessness of the situation tore away at his guts. It made him want to scream and claw at the stone walls in impotent rage. Yet for all his frustrations, he was unable to summon the passion that fed the dark side. Soon a challenger would step forward in the dueling ring, eager to take him down. And there was nothing he could do to stop that moment from coming. Lord Khan paced restlessly on the bridge of Nightfall as it orbited the industrial world of Brenthal IV. The Sith fleet occupied the Bormea sector, the region of space where the Perlemian trade route and the Hydian Way intersected. The Brotherhood of Darkness now controlled two of the most important hyperspace lanes serving the core worlds. Republic resistance to the ever-advancing Sith fleet was crumbling. And yet, despite this most recent victory, Khan felt something wasn't right. If anything, their conquest of the Bormea sector had been too easy. The worlds of Korralag, Chandrila, and Brenthal had all fallen in rapid succession, their defenders offering only token resistance before retreating in the face of the invading horde. In fact, he had sensed only a handful of Jedi among the Republic forces opposing them. This was not the first time the Jedi had been virtually absent from key battles. During encounters at Bespin, Sallust, and T'Nab, Khan had expected to be confronted by a fleet led by Jedi Master Hoth, the only Republic commander who seemed capable of winning victories against the Sith. But General Hoth, despite the reputation he had earned in the early stages of the war, was never there. At first, Khan suspected it was a trap, some elaborate scheme arranged by the wily Hoth to ensnare and destroy his sworn enemy. But if it was a trap, it had never been sprung. The Sith were pressing in from all sides. They were almost sitting on the doorstep of Coruscant itself. And the Jedi had all but vanished, seemingly having deserted the Republic in its time of greatest need. He should have been ecstatic. Without the Jedi, the war was as good as over. The Republic would fall in a matter of months, and the Sith would rule. But where had the Jedi gone? Khan didn't like it. The strange message Kopesh had sent just a few hours earlier had only added to his unease. The Twi'lek was coming to meet Nightfall with urgent news about Rusan. News he wouldn't transmit across regular channels. News so important, he felt he had to deliver it in person. An interceptor has just docked in Nightfall's landing bay, Lord Khan, one of the bridge crew reported. Despite his anxiousness to hear Kopesh's news, Lord Khan resisted the urge to go down to the landing bay to meet him. He felt something had gone very, very wrong, and it was important to maintain an appearance of calm assurance before his troops. Yet patience was not a virtue many of the Sith Lords possessed, and he couldn't keep himself from pacing as he waited for the Twi'lek to make his way to the bridge and deliver his ominous report. After what seemed like hours, but was no more than a few minutes, Kopesh finally arrived. His expression did nothing to alleviate Khan's growing apprehension as he crossed the bridge and gave a perfunctory bow.
I must speak with you in private, Lord Khan.
You may speak here, Khan assured him. What we say will not leave this ship.
The bridge crew of Nightfall had been hand-picked by Khan himself. All had sworn an oath to serve with absolute loyalty. They knew the harsh consequences should they break that oath.
Kopesh glanced suspiciously around the bridge, but the crew were all focused on their stations. None of them seemed even to notice him.
We've lost Rusan, he said, whispering despite Khan's assurances. The base set up on the surface. The orbiting fleet. All of it. Wiped out.
For a moment, Khan didn't speak. When he did, his voice had dropped to the same level as Kopesh's.
How did this happen? We have spies throughout the Republic military. All their fleets have fallen back to the core. All of them. They couldn't possibly have mustered enough strength to take back Rusan. Not without us knowing.
It wasn't the Republic, Kopesh replied. It was the Jedi. Hundreds of them. Thousands. Jedi Masters, Jedi Knights, Jedi Padawans, an entire army of Jedi.
Kopesh cursed loudly. None of the crew so much as glanced in his direction, a testament to their training and their fear of their commander.
Lord Hoth realized that the strength of the Jedi Order was spread too thin trying to defend the Republic.
Kopesh continued.
He's gathered them all into a single host with only one goal. Destroy the users of the dark side. They don't care about our soldiers and fleets anymore. All they want to do is wipe us out. The apprentices, the acolytes, the Sith Masters, and especially the Dark Lords. Lord Hoth himself is leading them.
The Twi'lek added, though Khan had already guessed this for himself.
They call themselves the Army of Light.
Kopesh paused to let the news sink in. Khan took several deep breaths, silently reciting the code of the Sith to bring his whirling thoughts back into focus. And then he laughed.
An army of light to oppose the Brotherhood of Darkness.
Kopesh stared at him with a bewildered expression.
Hoth knows the Jedi aren't capable of defeating our vast armies, Khan explained. Not anymore. The Republic is doomed. So now he concentrates exclusively on us, the leaders of those armies. Cut off the head and the body will die.
We should send our fleet to Rusan,
Kopesh suggested.
All of them.
Crush the Jedi in one fell swoop and wipe them from the galaxy forever.
Khan shook his head.
That's exactly what Hoth wants us to do. Divert our armies from the Republic, draw them away from Coruscant, give up all the ground we have gained in a foolish and pointless attack on the Jedi.
Pointless?
You say he has an army of Jedi, thousands of them. What chance does a fleet of mere soldiers have against such an enemy? Ships and weapons are no match for the power of the Force. Hoth knows this.
Finally, Kopesh nodded in understanding.
You always said this war would not be decided by military might.
Precisely. In the end, the Republic is merely an afterthought. Only through the complete annihilation of the Jedi Order can we achieve true victory. And Hoth has been kind enough to gather them all in one place for us.
But the Brotherhood is no match for the massed strength of the entire Jedi Order.
Kopesh protested.
There are too many of them and not enough of us.
Our numbers are greater than you think, Khan said. We have academies scattered throughout the galaxy.
We can swell our numbers with marauders from Honagar and Gentis. We can gather all the assassins trained at Umbara. We will command the students at Dathomir, Iridonia, and all the rest of the academies to join the ranks of the Brotherhood of Darkness. We will assemble our own army of Sith, one capable of destroying Hoth and his army of light.
And what of the Academy on Korriban?
Korpej asked. They will join the Brotherhood, but only after they have completed their training under Quartus.
We could use them against the Jedi,
Korpej pressed.
Korriban is home to the strongest of our apprentices.
That is precisely why it is too dangerous to bring them into this conflict, Khan explained. With strength come ambition and rivalry. In the heat of battle, their emotions will take over their minds. They will turn against each other. They will divide our ranks with infighting, while the Jedi remain united. He paused.
It has happened to the Sith too many times in the past. I will not allow it to happen again. They will stay with Cordis and complete their training. He will teach them discipline and loyalty to the Brotherhood. Only then will they join us on the field of battle.
Is that what you believe?
Korpej asked.
Or what Cordis has been telling you?
Don't let your mistrust of Cordis blind you to what we are trying to accomplish, Khan chided. His pupils are the future of the Brotherhood,
the future of the Sith.
I will not expose them to this war until they are ready. His tone clearly brooked no further argument. The apprentices at Korriban will join the Brotherhood in due time, but that time is not now.
Well, it better be soon,
Korpej muttered, only partially mollified.
I don't think we can beat Hoth without them.
Khan reached out and grasped the Twi'lek's meaty shoulder in a firm grip.
Never fear, my friend, he said with a smile. The Jedi will be no match for us. We will slaughter them at Rusan and wipe them from the face of the galaxy. The apprentices may be the future of the Brotherhood, but the present belongs to us. Much to Khan's relief, Korpej returned his smile. The leader of the Brotherhood would have been less pleased if he had known that much of the Twi'lek's satisfaction came from the knowledge that Cordis would miss out on the glory of the coming victory. Lord Cassim entered the opulently decorated chamber and gave a nod in the direction of his fellow master.
You wanted to see me?
Nurse from the front, Cordis said, rising slowly from his meditation mat. The Jedi have massed together under a single banner on Rusan. General Hoth is leading them. Lord Khan has gathered his own army. Even now, they are headed there to engage the Jedi.
Are we going to join them?
Cassim asked, his voice eager, his leku twitching at the thought of pitting his skills against the greatest warriors of the Jedi Order. Cordis shook his head.
Not us. None of the masters, and none of the students, unless you feel one of the apprentices is ready.
No, Cassim replied after a moment's consideration. Sidak, perhaps. He is strong enough, but his pride is too great, and he still has much to learn.
What about Bane? He showed great promise in disposing of Foharg.
Cassim shrugged.
That was a month ago. Since then, he has made almost no progress. Something is holding him back. Fear, I think.
Fear? Of the other students? Of Sirak?
No, nothing like that. He's finally seen what he is truly capable of. He's seen the full power of the dark side. I think he's afraid to face it.
Then he is of no further use to us, Cordis stated flatly. Focus on the other students. Don't waste your time on him.
The Blade Master was momentarily taken aback. He was surprised that Cordis would be so quick to give up on a student with such undeniable potential.
I think he just needs more time, he suggested. Most of our apprentices have been studying the ways of the Sith for many years, ever since they were children. Bane didn't begin his training with us until he was a full-grown adult.
I'm well aware of the circumstances surrounding his arrival at this academy,
Corda snapped, and Cassim suddenly realized what was really going on. Bane had been brought to Korriban by Lord Kopesh, and there was precious little love lost between Kopesh and the leader of the academy. Bane's failure would ultimately become a poor reflection on Cordis's most bitter rival.
The next time Bane approaches you, turn him away,
the Dark Lord told him, his tone leaving no doubt that his words were a command and not a request.
Make sure all the masters understand that he is no longer worthy of our teachings.
Cassim nodded his understanding. He would do as ordered. It wasn't fair to Bane, of course, but nobody ever claimed the Sith were fair.
Chapter 13.
Bane knew he had to do something. His situation was becoming desperate. He was still floundering, unable to call upon the power he had used to destroy Foharg. But now, his weakness had become public. Yesterday during the evening training session, he had approached Cassim to arrange a time for more one-on-one practice, hoping to break free of the lethargy that gripped him. But the Blade Master had refused him, shaking his head and turning his attention to one of the other students. The message was clear to everyone. Bane was vulnerable. As the students gathered in a circle on the top of the temple after the morning drills, Bane knew what had to be done. His reputation had protected him from the challenges of the other students. Now that reputation was gone. But he couldn't sit back passively, waiting for one of the other students to challenge him and take him down. He had to seize the initiative. He had to go on the attack. Today he had to be the first one to step into the ring. Of course, if he challenged one of the lesser students, everyone would see it as confirmation of the weakness he was trying to hide. There was only one way he could redeem himself in the eyes of the school and the masters. There was only one opponent he could call out. Several of the apprentices were still milling about, trying to find a place where they would be able to clearly observe the morning's action. It was customary to wait until everyone was in place before issuing a challenge. But Bane knew that the longer he waited, the harder his task would be. He stepped boldly into the center of the circle, drawing curious stares from the other students. Cassim fixed him with a disapproving gaze, but he tried to put it out of his mind.
"I have a challenge," he proclaimed. "I call out Sirak."
There was an excited buzz among the students, but Bane could barely hear it above the pounding of his own heart. Sirak rarely fought in actual combat. Bane had never even seen him in action. But he'd heard other students talk of Sirak's prowess in the dueling ring, telling wild tales of his unbeatable skills. Ever since the Zabrak had approached him on the stairs, Bane had watched his opponent during training sessions in preparation for this confrontation. And from what he'd seen, the seemingly exaggerated accounts of his prowess were all too accurate. Unlike most of the students, Sirak preferred the double-bladed training saber to the more traditional single blade. Apart from Cassim himself, Sirak was the only one Bane had ever seen wield the exotic weapon with any signs of skill. His technique seemed almost perfect to Bane's inexpert eye. He always seemed in complete control. He was always on the attack. Even in simple drills, his superiority over his opponents was obvious. Where most students took 2 to 3 weeks to learn a new sequence, Sirak was able to master one in a matter of days. And now Bane was about to face him in the dueling ring. The Zabrak stepped out from the crowd, moving slowly but gracefully as he responded to the challenge. Even walking to the center of the ring, he exuded an air of menace. He casually flourished his weapon as he approached, the twin Durasteel blades carving long, languid arcs through the air. Bane watched him come, feeling his heart and breathing quicken as his body released adrenaline into his system, instinctively readying itself for the coming battle. In contrast with his physical body, however, Bane felt no significant change in his emotional state. He had expected to feel a surge of fear and anger as Sirach approached, emotions he could feed off to rip through the lifeless veil and unleash the dark side. But the lethargic stupor still enveloped him, like a dull gray shroud.
"I wish you had challenged me earlier,"
Sirach whispered, his voice just loud enough for Bane to hear.
"In the first week after Fohag's death, many thought you were my equal. I would have gained great prestige in defeating you. That is no longer the case."
Sirach had stopped his advance and was standing several meters away. His double-bladed training saber still danced slowly through the air. It moved as if it were alive, a creature anticipating the hunt, too excited to remain motionless.
"There will be little glory in defeating you now," he repeated, "but I will take great pleasure in your suffering."
Behind Sirach, Bane saw Lokai and Yivra, the others of Brak apprentices, push their way to the front of the crowd to get a better view of their champion. The brother wore a cruel grin, the sister, an expression of hungry anticipation. Bane did his best to tune out the eagerness on their red faces, letting them blend into the unimportant background scenery of the spectators. All his concentration was focused on the fluid movements of the unfamiliar weapon in Sirach's hands. He had tried to memorize the sequences Sirach worked on during the drills. Now, he was looking for clues that would tip his opponent's hand, that might reveal which sequence he planned to use to begin the battle. If Bane guessed right, he could counterattack and possibly end the battle in the first pass. It was his best chance at victory. But without being able to draw on the force, his odds of correctly guessing which sequence his foe would choose were very, very slim. Sirach raised the double-bladed saber up above his head, spinning it so fast it was nothing but a blur, then lunged forward. One end came down in a savage overhead strike that Bane easily parried, but the move was only a feint, setting up a slashing attack at the waist from the opposite blade. Recognizing the maneuver at the last second, Bane could do nothing more than throw himself into a backward roll, narrowly escaping injury. His foe was on him even before he got to his feet, the twin blades slicing down in an alternating rhythm of attacks, left, right, left, right. Bane blocked, rolled, twisted, and blocked again, turning back the flurry. He tried a leg sweep, but Sirach anticipated the move and nimbly leapt clear, giving Bane just enough time to scramble to his feet. The next round of attacks kept Bane in full retreat, but he was able to prevent Sirach from gaining an advantage by giving ground and reverting to basic defensive sequences. He was still desperately trying to gain some advantage by watching his opponent's moves. At one moment, Sirach seemed to be using the jabs and thrusts of Vapad, the most aggressive and direct of the seven traditional forms. But in the middle of a sequence, he would suddenly shift to the power attacks of Dujem So, generating such force that even a block strike caused Bane to stagger back. A quick turn or rotation of the weapon, and one of the twin blades was suddenly swinging in again at an awkward angle, causing Bane to reel off balance as he knocked it aside. There was a brief lull in the action as the two combatants paused to reevaluate their strategies, each breathing heavily. Sirach twirled his weapon in a quick, complex sequence that brought the saber under his right arm, around behind his back, over his left shoulder, and around to the front. Then he smiled and did it in reverse. Bane watched the extravagant flourish with a sinking feeling. Sirach had been toying with him in the first few passes, dragging the fight out so his victory would seem more impressive. Now he was showing his true skill, using sequences that blended several forms at once, switching rapidly among different styles and complex patterns Bane had never seen before. It was just one more sign of the Zabrak's superiority. If Bane tried to combine different styles into a single sequence, he'd probably gouge out an eye or smack himself in the back of the head. It was clear he was overmatched. His only hope was that his enemy would get careless and make a mistake. Sirach moved in again, his training saber moving so quickly that Bane could hear the sizzle as it split the air. Bane leapt forward to meet the challenge, trying to call up the power of the dark side to anticipate and block the dual blades, moving too fast for his eyes to see. He felt the force flowing through him, but it seemed distant and hollow. The veil was still there. He was able to keep the paralyzing edges of Sirak's saber at bay, but it required him to concentrate all his attention on controlling his own blade, leaving him vulnerable to the real purpose of the attack being unleashed against him. Bane's skull exploded as Sirak's forehead slammed into his face. Pain turned his vision into a field of silver stars. The cartilage of his nose gave way with a sickening crunch, a geyser of blood gushing forth. Blind and dazed, he was able to parry the next strike only by instinct, guided by the faintest whisper of the Force. But Sirak spun as his saber was turned away and delivered a back roundhouse kick that shattered Bane's kneecap. Screaming, Bane collapsed, his free hand slamming into the ground as he braced his fall. Sirak crushed the fingers under his boot, grinding them into the unyielding stone of the temple roof. A knee came up, fracturing his cheek and jawbone with a thunderous crack. With the last desperate burst, Bane tried to hurl his opponent backward with the dark side. Sirak brushed the impact aside, easily deflecting it with the force shield he had wrapped himself in at the start of the duel. Then he moved in close to finish the job with his blades. The first blow hit with the impact of a landspeeder slamming into an Irax, breaking Bane's right wrist. The training saber dropped from his suddenly nerveless grasp. The next strike took him higher up on the same arm, dislocating his elbow. A simple kick to the face sent jagged bits of tooth shooting out of his mouth and bolts of pain shooting through his broken jaw. He slumped forward, barely conscious, as Sirak stepped back and lowered his saber, reaching out with a free hand to grab Bane around the throat with the crushing grip of the Force. He raised his arm, lifting the muscular Bane as if he were a child, then hurled him across the ring. Bane felt another bone snap as he crashed to the ground, but his body had passed into a state of shock, and there was no longer any pain. He lay motionless in a crumpled, twisted heap. Blood from his nose and mouth clogged his throat. A coughing fit racked his body, and he heard, rather than felt, the grinding of his broken ribs. Everything began to go dim. He caught a glimpse of a pair of blood-flecked boots striding toward him. And then, Bane surrendered himself to the merciful darkness. Kopej shook his head as he studied the battle plan Khan had laid out on a makeshift table in the middle of his tent. The hollow map of Rusan's terrain showed the positions of the Sith forces as glowing red triangles floating above the map. The Jedi positions were represented by green squares. Despite this high-tech advancement, the rest of the map was a simple two-dimensional representation of the surrounding area's topography. It did nothing to convey the grim devastation that had left Rusan a virtual wasteland, ravaged by war. Three great fleet battles had taken place high above the world in the past year, scattering debris from the losing side across the sparsely populated world each time. Scorched and twisted hulls that had once been ships had crashed into the lush forests, igniting wildfires that had reduced much of the small world's surface to ash and barren soil. Rusan, despite its meager size, had become a world of major importance to both the Republic and the Sith. Strategically located on the edges of the Inner Rim, it also stood at what most considered the border between the Republic's dangerous frontier and its safe and secure core. Rusan was a symbol. Conquering it represented the inevitable advance of the Sith and their conquest of the Republic. Liberating it would be emblematic of the Jedi's ability to drive the invaders away and protect the Republic's citizens. The result was an endless cycle of battles, with neither side willing to admit defeat. The first battle of Rusan had seen the invading Sith fleet rout the Republic forces, using the elements of surprise and the strength of Khan's battle meditation. The second battle saw the Republic try to reclaim control of Rusan and fail, driven back by the enemy's superior numbers and firepower. The third battle in the skies above Rusan marked the emergence of the Army of Light. Instead of Republic cruisers and fighters, the Sith found themselves facing a fleet made up primarily of one and two crew fighters, piloted exclusively by Jedi. The common soldiers who had joined Khan's army were no match for the Force, and Rusan was saved, for a time. The Sith had responded to the Army of Light by amassing the full numbers of the Brotherhood of Darkness into a single army, then unleashing it on Rusan. The war that had ravaged the world from on high moved down to the surface, with far more devastating consequences. Compared with space fleet battles, ground combat was brutal, bloody, and visceral. Kopesh slammed his fist down on the table.
"It's hopeless, Scum!"
The other Dark Lords gathered in the tent murmured in agreement.
"The Jedi positions are too well defended. They have all the advantages."
Kopesh went on angrily.
"High ground, entrenched fortifications, superior numbers. We can't win this battle."
"Look again," Khan replied. "The Jedi have spread themselves too thin." The big Twi'lek studied the map in more detail and realized Khan was right. The Jedi perimeter extended too far out from their base camp. It took him barely a moment to realize why. The clash between armies of Jedi and Sith, led by Jedi Masters and Dark Lords, had shaken the foundations of the world. The power of the Force raged unchecked across the battlefields, like the thunder of an exploding star. Towns, villages, and individual homes caught up in the storm had been wiped out, leaving only death and destruction behind. Civilians caught up in the wake of war had been forced to flee, becoming refugees of an epic battle between the champions of light and dark. Seeing their suffering, the Jedi had sought to console, comfort, and protect the innocent citizens of Rusan. They planned their strategies around defending civilian settlements and homesteads, even at the expense of resources and tactical advantage. The Sith, of course, made no such concessions.
"The Jedi's compassion is a weakness," Khan continued. "One we can exploit. If we concentrate our full numbers on a single point,
we can breach their lines. Then the advantage will be ours."
The assembled generals and strategists of the Brotherhood of Darkness nodded in agreement. Several raised their voices in roars of triumph and congratulations. Only Kopesh refused to join in the celebrations.
"The Army of Light still outnumbers us 2-1.
The heavyset Twi'lek reminded them.
"Their lines may be overextended in some places, but we don't know where they are vulnerable. They know our scouts are watching. They hide their numbers just as we hide ours. If we attack a location where their numbers are strong, we'll be slaughtered."
The rest of the generals stilled their voices, no longer swept up in their leader's enthusiasm, now that the glaring flaw in his plan had been exposed. Again, there were rumbles of disagreement and displeasure. Kopesh ignored the reaction of the other Dark Lords. For all their power, for all their ambition, they were like so many banthas, blindly following the rest of the herd. In theory, everyone in the Brotherhood of Darkness was equal. But in practice, Khan ruled the others. Kopesh understood this, and he was willing to follow him. The Sith needed a strong and charismatic leader, a man of vision, to quell the infighting that had plagued their ranks. Khan was just such a leader, and he was normally a brilliant military tactician. But this plan was madness. Suicide. Unlike the rest of the rabble, Kopesh wasn't about to follow their leader into certain death.
"You underestimate me, Kopesh,"
Khan reassured him, his voice calm and confident, as if he had anticipated this question all along and had an answer prepared. Perhaps he did.
"We won't strike until we know exactly where they are most vulnerable,"
the Dark Lord explained.
"By the time we attack, we'll know the precise number and composition of every unit and patrol along the perimeter."
"How?"
Kopesh demanded.
"Even our Umbaran shadow spies can't provide us with that kind of detail. Not quickly enough to use it in planning our attack. We have no way of getting the information we'd need."
Khan laughed.
"Of course we do. One of the Jedi will give it to us."
The flaps covering the entrance of the long tent serving as the Sith war room parted as if on cue, and a young human woman, clad in the robes of the Jedi Order, stepped through. She was of average height, but that was the only thing about her that could ever be called average. She had thick raven hair that tumbled down past her shoulders.
Her face and figure were perfect examples of the human female form. Her tri-copper hued skin was set off by green eyes, smoldering with a heat that was both a warning and an invitation. She moved with the lithe grace of a Twi'lek dancer. As she walked the length of the assembled Dark Lords, a coy smile on her lips, as she pretended not to hear their whispers of surprise. Korpesh had seen many striking females in his time. Several of the female Dark Lords gathered